Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Motorsport magazine for the very best in motor racing.
Okay, moving on. The editor is halfway through his pint of Guinness, and we are sort of halfway through this latest Motorsport magazine podcast. We move on to Robert Kubica. Was he the sleeping giant of the season? Well, it's often said that Lewis Hamilton fears him more than any other driver, but not in a Renault. Robert Kubica often pushed his car into the Red Bull Ferrari McLaren mix this year, but he could rarely maintain that challenge. It's universally agreed, though, that he can challenge for the title in a truly competitive car. But we're starting to wonder, will he ever get one of those? Nigel?
Well, first of all, I'm sure he will get one of those. I don't think there's any doubt about that. I mean, I think Kubica is sort of about as good as there is. I believe Alonso is the best. But I suspect that Alonso probably fears Kubica like Lewis does. I really like Kubica. I mean, he's a very nice guy. Very, very nice, dry sense of humour. And he appears very laid back, in terms of his personality, he is very laid back. But I don't think he's laid back in terms of the way he drives a team. And I think he's driven Renault hard this year, and I think it's shown in the results. They've got a fairly tiny budget compared with the McLarens and Ferraris and
it's not a fair comparison, is it,
Red
these days
and
no.
so on
no. As Damien said, Nigel, it is all about having the best car.
Yeah,
and,
it is.
And would but isn't part of being a great champion getting yourself into the best car?
It is, and it's also what you do with that team when you get there. I mean, I think we're just talking about Alonso now. I think if you look at what Alonso has done for Ferrari compared with what Kimi Raikkonen did, for instance, as a case in point. I think Kubica has driven Renault hard this year in the same way that Barrichello has driven Williams hard this year. And there's proof positive that, that the car is everything. You know, Rubens had 3 years wasting his time at Honda, 1 year of Braun. And there's no question through the second half of 2009 he certainly had the measure of Jensen, and he won 2 Grand Prix and won them well. And this year he's in a Williams, and it's been a struggle again. But look at the progress Williams have made on the back of it. So a driver can have an immense effect on the progress of a team, and I think Robert is bound in the end to finish up in a Ferrari or a McLaren, and I think when that happens, the rest need to watch out.
I just hope he doesn't have to wait as long as Jensen did to get in a competitive car. Jensen had to wait 10 years to get his chance. I don't think he'll have to wait that long, Robert. But it just seems such a shame to see him not where he should be. But having said that, I do think Renault deserve some credit this year because financially, it's not easy for them. No. Genie Capital have taken it over, and it's been well documented that they are strapped for cash. And I think Eric Boulier has done a great job of keeping that team together. Robert Kubica has clearly galvanised them.
Yes,
on the circuit, and he's done a very, very. I mean, he's certainly in my mind, in terms of our top 10 drivers of the year, he'd be knocking on the door of the top five, even though we've got 5 championship contenders, because comparatively he's been as good as anyone.
I mean, I would say Kubica And Nico, I think, you know, there's almost, in my head, there's certainly a top six, which includes Kubica, and if you're going to have seven, then Rosberg. But, yeah, I mean, I think if Kubica had been in a front-running car this year, he would be going to, you know, he would be a contender for the World Championship without any question at all.
I think Renault also feels like quite a different team to what it has been for the last, you know, few years. And I think last year, Alonso didn't put as much into it as he has with Ferrari. Because he knew he was going to Ferrari. And I think the team suffered from that as well. But also this year, with Petrov as a teammate, he hasn't been pushed by his teammate. So it's quite good. It puts him in a very good light because he's just completely annihilated Petrov.
Yeah.
But you know, I'd love to see him in the same car as Alonso or Hamilton. And
me too.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, maybe if the Malaysian Proton organization puts a lot of money into Renault, maybe in. Oh no, sorry, we're not predicting next year. Sorry. Right. Okay.
Now, one thing I would just one point I would add about Kubica, I think, and it's almost a kind of negative thing in a way, but it truly isn't that way. He makes fewer mistakes than any of them. I think, you know, Jensen makes remarkably few mistakes. Robert is almost like Prost in that respect. Hardly ever screws up.
Let's move on from Robert Kubica and Renault to Rubens Barrichello. Is he Formula One's Peter Pan? Well, Nico Hülkenberg was tipped for greatness at the start of his rookie season, but the reality has been, actually, that Formula One's most experienced driver in history led the Williams team brilliantly during this, his 18th season in the top flight. Rubens is probably driving as well as he's ever done, so how long can he go on? How much longer will we see Rubens on the Formula One grid? Nigel, I think we're all fans of Rubens, aren't we?
Yeah, I think you have to be. I mean, I can't remember where it was now, but I remember a race that when he was not prevented from winning in his Ferrari days, and he won the race, and I remember bumping into Brundle in the paddock about half an hour after the race, and big, big smile on Martin's face, and he just said, "Proper bloke wins Grand Prix." And I think that's everybody's perception of him. He is a proper bloke. He's in many ways, even though he's been around all these years, and God knows, you know, he's writing his autobiography at the moment, and if he writes everything he knows, it could be a most interesting volume. But yet, somehow, he remains in a kind of way curiously innocent. And his love of Grand Prix racing and simply driving these cars is, he says, even greater now than when he started. And I believe him. Sam Michael, Williams' technical director, has worked with some pretty good drivers in his time. And he told me this year that he said Rubens is the best Formula One driver I've ever worked with, and how he hasn't been world champion two or three times I will never
understand.
Well,
I think we partly know the answer to that question, don't we?
Well, I think we do. The Maranello year, certainly. But I think you say how long will he go on? At his age, you know, drivers tend to reach a point when people don't employ them anymore, and you know, you think, look,
what,
people,
sort of 41-ish.
Well, yeah. Well, unless you are, but it happened to Gerhard Berger. It happened to Jean Alesi. People like and it could easily happen to him. And you know, for the first time in a long time, Williams have looked like a proper team. I'm not just talking about Hülkenberg's pole in Brazil. I mean, they've made big, big progress on a tiny budget.
What do you think of Hülkenberg?
There have been flashes of wow, you know, where's he come from? You know, you suddenly see he's P5 in qualifying and that sort of thing. He's crashed a lot. I wasn't impressed at all with the way he drove against Webber and at Monza, for instance. You know, some of the things he did to keep him back. I mean, very reminiscent of Michael. Mm. But I think he probably is close to the complete package, you know, with a few more years behind him. He just needs to be... He needs to be able to progress with, you know, with decent teams. I would hate to see him sort of, you know, pitched into a poor drive for reasons of, you know, sponsorship and nothing else.
I think nowadays, without any testing, you know, it's so difficult to expect these rookies to come in. You've seen it with Petrov, we've seen it with Hülkenberg, and you know they hardly get any time in the car compared to 5 years ago. And so you've got to expect them to make mistakes. And really, with new teams, all they give them are a few races. And then from then on, they expect them to be, you know, in the points or not crashing. And I think it's really sad to see some of the drivers come in and have a slight, like Petrov. I think he's a good driver.
Hmm. I've felt quite sorry for Petrov. And I think whoever was saying earlier on about Eric Boullier has done a very good job this year. He certainly has. I've been impressed. But I think he's probably spoken a little bit too much about, well, we might keep Petrov, we might not. Mm. Well, we'll see how he goes. Well, you know, he needs to qualify better. Well, if he gets a few points. And I think that's just multiplied the pressure on Petrov, and I've felt quite sorry for him.
Yeah.
Because I think he is a pretty handy driver.
I think in Hülkenberg's case, that would probably account for the Monza performance, because he's got to take his chances, and that was a great chance in front of everyone to try and stay in front of Webber, and I think he overstepped the mark. But it's hardly surprising, given rookie driver, as Ed quite rightly says, so little time in the car.
Absolutely, and where they've all learned their lessons, you know.
Okay, well, we could talk about all these things forever and ever and ever, couldn't we? In fact, we could probably talk about it until the pub opens again. The Ram here in Chelsea in London has gone very quiet. Most people are probably back at work, I guess. Okay, moving on again, the new teams. Well, it's been a talking point this year, that's for sure, but have they been wasting their time? Lotus, Virgin and Hispania achieved what USF1 could not achieve by making it to the grid in Bahrain and surviving their first seasons, although in Hispania's case, making it to Abu Dhabi was far from a foregone conclusion. Now all three teams have to justify their places in Grand Prix racing by climbing off the bottom rungs of the ladder. But can they do it? Damien, let's start with you. Eh?
I think, first of all, they all deserve credit for getting an F1 team up and running from a standing start, because it's everyone knows how hard it is these days. Lotus and Virgin have clearly done a much better job than Hispania. The Hispania thing has been really not really worthy of Formula 1 in 2010. It reminded me a little bit of the old days of the early 90s, when you get these start-up teams come from nowhere, not do very much except embarrass themselves and disappear. Now, Hispania is still there, but they haven't featured in any way for me. I mean, the whole Dallara thing was very confusing, and I'd imagine very damaging for Dallara, because they pulled out of the project before the season even began. The car was labelled a Dallara, and they got a lot of criticism for not being good enough, but they hardly had any involvement after building the car. So all in all, it's been quite a damaging experience. I would have thought Bruno Senna, not great for him in terms of his future prospects. But I think the Lotus and Virgin story is more interesting, that they've been nip and tuck for a lot of the year in terms of being the best of the new teams. Lotus, I think, would you agree, Nigel, they've certainly edged it.
Yeah. Yeah.
But what a long way to go for both of them.
Yeah, I think really the interesting thing is they haven't really significantly closed the gap, have they?
No, that's the trouble, isn't it?
And we started off with sort of a 4 or 5 second a lap difference to the front of the grid, which is, Jesus, you know, it's a lifetime.
It's like a GP2 car.
Formula One terms. And there were races when, yeah, particularly when the HRTs or Hispanias or whatever we call them, were qualifying slower than the GP2 cars. And you think, how can that happen? I mean, for a start, you know, they've got a load more horsepower. How can they be slower than... So, I mean, I'm probably quite harsh when it comes to backmarker teams than I always have been. There have been races this year when, you know, the sort of serious end of the grid has been trying to find its way around the HRTs or whatever. And I just honestly think they're a thundering nuisance.
Maybe what it has told us, which, okay, we knew already, but has reminded us big time, is just how fantastically difficult it is to win a Grand Prix.
Yeah.
Never mind a championship.
No.
And I would not for a moment support the likes of Hispania, you know, although, as Damien says, all credit to them for getting going. But the difference in resources from one end of the grid to the other is light years, isn't it? It's light years.
I met up with Trevor Carlin the other day, and he's going to be racing in GP2 next year. I said, you know, is this, you know, a sort of before stepping into Formula One? He said, absolutely not. He said, how could a team like us ever compete with Ferrari and McLaren? He said, it's taken them decades and billions of dollars. And he said, you know, you can't, and he said, the nature of the game is that these, you know, a couple of the smaller teams on the back of the grid will change hands on an annual basis and things like that. And I think the problem with the Hispania was, I was talking to Bruno Senna, and he was saying that Dallara did a good job, but the fact that there was just zero development, he said, it just crippled them. And so then, you know, that started being blamed on the Dallara, and that wasn't the case.
I think it's interesting that you know, I take Nigel's view about backmarket teams, but what to me has been much more disappointing than Hispania or Virgin has been Lotus. And I only say that because they're constantly talking up the car and the team, and yet nothing happens.
Well, I think Lotus gave up. I think, you know, Mike Gascoigne said them, and Lotus gave up development of this car long, long ago. And all their thoughts are on 2011. And they'll have a Renault engine and et cetera, et cetera. It's going to be... I mean, Lotus do show signs of, you know, of aspiring to becoming a serious team. I remember interviewing Bernie about 15 years ago. And at that time, there were one or two little teams. And Bernie had no interest in them, didn't make a start on it. He just thought essentially they were a nuisance. And he wished they'd go away and compete in a formula where they could be competitive. And if you think about, I mean, fundamentally, you know, we have these three new teams because of the situation that arose with Max Mosley and his, you know, capping costs and budgets when it was, budget was going to be, what, 30 million, then 40 million, then it got increased a bit more and all the rest of it.
And lots of cosmetics.
And these teams, yes. And this is when the whole thing looked like possibly splintering apart. And the official FIA Formula One World Championship not having too many competing cars. So I think... I think they sort of came into it thinking that the costs were going to be much lower than they have turned out to be. Whether they would do the same now, knowing what they know now, I wonder. But Bernie just thought, he used to call them start line specials. I don't like these start line specials.
Well, I think a good comparison is MotoGP, in the sense that you'd have thought if ever you needed a big grid, it would be in motorcycles, because motorcycles are smaller, and yet MotoGP has a very small grid, and the racing is unbelievably exciting. I don't think numbers are the thing, are they?
I think that's motorbike racing, and in general, it's an extremely exciting race to watch, and I think having 10 Formula 1 cars going around a track is not my idea of a good race.
You know, maybe not 10, but
even if they're off the pace, I prefer them to be there than not.
Bernie was always quite happy with having 20 good cars, and I can't really see it. And he always said, you know, we're in the quantity-quality business, not the quantity business. And I can't tell you honestly, I've been aware of there being half a dozen more cars in Formula 1 this year than last year. I've been quite surprised how much it's been a second division.
So the jury's out, really, we think Lotus has great potential. Yep, would that be a fair
summary? I think Lotus is in the best position,
yes,
to, with with Gascoigne set up that he's got there, the Renault engines, the Red Bull drivetrain for next year, it all sounds promising. Virgin is less of a known quantity because they go about things in a very different way with the CFD technology, which they've put so much onto, and we'll see what the future brings for them.
I think I'll be interested to see how long Richard Branson stays with it, because it's people like him aren't used to losing.
He's not, but on the other hand, it's not costing him anything, so I mean, historically, you know, Branson likes maximum publicity for minimum outlay, doesn't he? I mean, as we saw from Braun in 09. So I think he won't like being associated with lack of success, but on the other hand, as I say, it does splash the name about, and it's the other people who are paying.
Well, I think discussing Sir Richard Branson's business modus operandi is a very good time to move on. To what I consider to be the talking point of all talking points of this season, and that is the season itself. Because, you know, we need to look, don't we, guys, at what are the elements that have come together to make this so exciting? I suppose, you know, Formula 1 2010 will remember as one of the best in history. Nigel's a good judge of that. But is
millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
The quality of the racing as good as it should be. Nigel, can we just take a look at what we have this year that we didn't have in 2009, or what we don't have that we did have?
Well, simply, what we don't have is refueling. You know, Bahrain, the first race, was probably one of the half-dozen most boring races I've ever been to in my life. And I remember at the airport, we all got planes at about 2 o'clock in the morning on that night. And I remember at the airport, it was sort of such a hue and cry about, oh, God, well, what have we done? Oh, jeez, you know, and there was panic. We've got to change it. We've got to do, what do we do? Do we bring back the refueling? And Bernie, fortunately, was very sanguine about it and just said, let it settle. And eventually the hysterics calmed down, and, you know, and thank God they did, because once it did settle down, everything was that in Bahrain everybody was ultra conservative, because nobody had any real clue how long tires were going to last on a full fuel tank and everything else. So everybody was ultra conservative. Once it settled down, I think we had a fantastic season. I always thought refueling was a complete waste of time anyway, because essentially all it did was keep the cars in more or less qualifying spec the whole time. And so the sprint for 20 laps, stop, new tyres, fuel, bit more fuel. Car was always light, always on relatively fresh rubber. And nothing ever happened, and weren't we all surprised?
I think one of the reasons as well is just because there are so many competitive teams and good drivers.
You can't really fault it. I mean, I think some of the drivers have professed frustrations that once a race starts, there's not much they can do on strategy because they've got what they've got. Without, you know, you could pit early for more fuel, or try and stretch it out later or whatever. But I think, in essence, we've got Grand Prix racing back again, as it was historically meant to be, because there has always been an endurance element to Grand Prix racing. It isn't sprint racing. And although it's interesting that in the age of the where TV matters more than anything else, that we should actually end up going back to a more traditional form of Grand Prix racing. And I think it's worked brilliantly. I mean, that Bahrain race, I was as worried as everyone, but I didn't need to be, did I? How many, there's been very few dud races this year. Most of them have been interesting in one form or other.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the thing about the ban on refuelling, what it's done is, for the first time in a long time, it's made tyres important again. Tyre wear important again, and how you treat your tyres, which really wasn't a factor at all, you know, for like 15, 20 years. And I think if you throw in the fact that we've had three companies have managed to make almost comparably competitive cars. Okay, say Red Bull has a discernible advantage, but Ferrari and McLaren are thereabouts. And also, it's the best now. I think is the best crop of drivers we've had since the mid late 80s.
Damien's right. You can't be anything but positive about 2010, can you? I can't remember looking forward so much to a race for a long time.
I still think they need to sort out not being able to follow a car closely. You're never going to sort that. It's Grand Prix racing, but they've got to do something to help it, because you can see people closing in like half a second a lap, a second a lap, get to within that 2 second gap, and it's like hitting a brick wall.
It's very hard to turn back time on this, though, isn't it? You know, you can't deny the fact that the last 20 years have happened, and that we have to live with aero. Even if they vastly reduce the size of the wings like they did in the beginning of 2009, the teams find a way around it, and there's such clever people in Formula 1. I think you're always going to live with this. And actually, I think there's been quite a bit of overtaking this year. Okay, some tracks make it harder than others, but overall, I think the balance isn't pretty good.
And to be fair to Sauber, Ed, they have found a way of doing this, that he's called Kamui Kobayashi. we'd all like to see more overtaking, wouldn't we? But I'm sure Nigel would agree with me. I think he would anyway. That, you know, there never was a time when we saw huge amounts of overtaking in Grand Prix racing, on a, you know, regularly, was there?
No, you're probably right. You're probably right, but certainly more than there is now. Certainly more than there has been in this era.
Yes.
It's purely because of aerodynamics. If you let me momentarily just go back to the Hockenheim thing with Massa and Alonso. You know, Alonso is a quicker driver than Massa, no question. I don't think anybody in the world would argue with that. They were identical cars, but Alonso, being a quicker driver, didn't mean that he was able to overtake a slower teammate.
So what can be done about it? Do any of us know?
Well, it seems to me... some of the downforce, more of the downforce from, you know, if you like, go back to ground effect to a degree, so that the downforce is created by tunnels, if you like, under the car, rather than this endless reliance on wings and hideous winglets and that sort of thing.
I mean, Damien, you say, you know, we can't turn the clock back, we can't go back in time, but on the other hand, this is a pretty important element, isn't it? There is no racing without overtaking, so surely somebody somewhere has to come up with a solution.
Yes, they do. I guess the frustrating thing was there was this technical... working group, the overtaking working group that was created, that a lot of good work was done, but then you get a team come in with a double diffuser and all that work was undone in terms of creating more overtaking. There's always going to be someone coming up with something that will create dirty air, that will make it difficult for cars to follow each other. I think in the next few years we're going to see more and more change, because you've got the new engine regulations coming in 2013. There's regulation changes on the way, which we may see an improvement. But as I say, I think the balance isn't too bad. You get certain races like Monza this year. Monza's very hard to overtake. That was still a thrilling Grand Prix, even though there's no overtaking, because the battle between Alonso and Button, there was nothing between them at all, and that for me was exciting. They weren't dicing, passing each other going into the chicanes, but it's still Grand Prix racing, and I don't think it's as big a problem as sometimes made out to be.
I think from an entertainment point of view it is a big problem, because I think if you don't have people fighting for the lead, i.e. passing and repassing, then it's not a race. It's not thrilling. It's not, my God, who's going to be, you know, will he get by? No, it's, well, we know he won't get by.
That's true. I think the only thing is, Rob, I don't think it should ever be easy. That's the point. And I remember that era on the super speedways in the kart days when they had the Hanford wing. Do you remember that? Mm. Which was palpably absurd, because you get two cars having a hell of a race at a place like Michigan, but you knew that A would pass B exactly there every lap, and B would repass exactly there every lap, and so it ceased to mean anything.
And one last thing, you know, it's easy to criticise the circuits. Some of the circuits are better than others, we know that. I would say there are examples this year where you think the new Silverstone was a really good new Grand Prix circuit, the new infield section, but they didn't really create an overtaking point. One thing for me that I would do was tighten the Brooklands corner to be a much heavier braking corner so that you could try and overtake someone into there. That, you know, there's always things you can do to the circuits to try and improve things. I'm not saying it's not a problem, I just don't think it's as big a problem as it's sometimes made out to be.
Yeah, I mean, we all want to see Grand Prix racing on proper tracks, don't we? I think.
Well, we would like to see that, yes, Rob.
Sorry, I thought you meant me.
We would like to see that, Rob, yes. A great many of them becoming increasingly unused.
Yes, they are. Very, very depressing. Hobby horse for Mr. Roback and I, this one. Okay, let's move on again. We're nearly through our review of the season, but we can't leave it without talking about the F-duct. McLaren's aero innovation, which allowed drivers to control the airflow to the rear wing down the straight. And this, of course, was in the very best tradition of clever thinking in Formula One. Other teams copied it, but the fact that few made it work highlighted just how brilliant it was. Typically, it's been banned for 2011. But is it right, do we think, for the FIA to constantly peg back inspired engineering? Well, it's that sort of leads on from where we just were, doesn't it?
I think the, you know, Formula One is such a good forum for, you know, the technical side of it, and I find that really exciting. But, I mean, the problem with the F-duct, we saw with Alonso, at one point getting to a corner, he had both his hands off the steering wheel, which, you know, is not a great situation, and he, sure enough, he ran wide and missed the apex and things, which, you know, is basically what, you know, what you had to do to work the F-duct. You had to have at least one of your hands off the steering wheel, and that's not particularly safe position to be in. But, you know, so this one I think they should have banned, but, you know, I would like to see a bit more freedom in the rules for technical innovation.
The problem you got is variables make good racing, and the more variables you add in, the more chance you've got of cars being unequal. Who actually wants equal cars? Because if you have equal cars, you just get a procession. And that's why Formula One should never be a one-make formula, because you want people coming up with alternatives and being encouraged to do so. And it just seems to me that sometimes Formula One is just too restrictive. And I think the engineers, you know, would welcome. Obviously, you've got to keep control of costs. We all understand that. And it's always been the case that you come up with something and then the FIA ban it. It's always and that's the nature of the sport, trying to contain it. But it just seems to me a shame to just do a point-blank ban of something when, as soon as it comes in, that there's not a way of actually encouraging innovation more.
Well, it's funny, it's funny listening to you talking about it, because I seem to remember Pat Simmons saying that, you know, Formula One regulations were so proscriptive these days as almost to be absurd, because there was no room for creativity like we see from people like Pat Simmons and particularly Adrian Newey, and in the old days from Gordon Murray. So surely we've got, never mind banning stuff, there's virtually no room to introduce innovation, is there?
No, I think, and also one of the things that you get out of this is the look of the cars. You know, and the new cars, the look has grown on me. But if you took all the paintwork and the sponsors off these cars, I say there's a very, very small percentage of people who could tell one from the other, and most of those would have been the ones who designed them. And I think that's really sad. You know, the days of differently shaped Grand Prix cars are long gone, sadly.
Yeah, that's true. And I think, you know, the other thing, it's all very well to say, to think back to the sort of, you know, the days of Gordon Murray and huge innovation and all the rest of it. And I agree, I mean, I loved all that too. But it's very, 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 potentially very expensive.
Oh, yeah.
And you know, and what are we short of at the moment?
Well, what are we short of? I mean, I read in the newspaper, in a proper newspaper, this was, that Red Bull Racing, Formula One team, had spent £157 million on Formula One last year, 2009.
Pricey business.
Well, my point is that for the top teams, this business of money is a problem. It's just not true. I mean, yeah, I'm sorry. If money was a problem, you don't spend between 150 and heaven knows how much other noughts, million dollars, on Formula One racing.
But if you had no restrictions, you'd have three teams on the grid.
That is, yeah, you're right. That's the problem.
Yeah. But there's a balance. I think we'd all agree. There's a balance somewhere which they need to reach where they allow engineers' scope to be innovative without. And I'm not saying I've got all the answers here because it's not easy to solve.
Anyway,
we're losing the F duct next year, but we are, of course, getting Kers back.
Yeah.
Okay. And Pirelli tyres, something completely different.
Yep.
Well, still tyres, but you know
yep.
what I mean.
Yeah.
Okay. well, we are just about through, which is probably a good thing because there's no one else in the Ram pub anymore except us. We were going to talk, Mr. Editor, were we not, in closing about Jean Todt?
Yeah, one of the points about this season, I think, which has been really refreshing, is I think it's the least political season we can remember. The only real big controversy of the year really was the team orders thing with Ferrari at Hockenheim. But apart from that, there's been very little. And I mean, Todt has had an incredibly low profile this year, and we all feared that he would, it would be more of the same after Max Mosley, and it hasn't been at all. We should have, probably with hindsight, recognised that he's his own man, and he would do things his own way. And sure enough, I think he's been great the way that he's been working behind the scenes. I think, you know, not everyone likes the way he does things, not everyone likes what he's doing behind the scenes, but it's been refreshing from a public point of view. And from the fans' point of view, that we've actually been able to concentrate on what matters this year.
I think sort of one of the very telling moments was immediately after Hockenheim. You know, there were quotes from hundreds of people, but I did not see one from Todt, whereas Mosley would have been right in there.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, in a way, you could say Todt was in a kind of embarrassing position there, because it was really only because of his actions at Ferrari with Schumacher and Barrichello that the ban on team orders had come in the first place. So he was in a bit of a sort of tenuous position at the time, but I must say, I mean, I agree with everything Damien said. I feared, because Max Mosley was so strongly behind him, and almost daring, you know, anyone to vote for anybody else, I did have my fears that we were in for more of the same. But in point of fact, I mean, from everything I hear, you know, Mosley and his cohorts, many of whom I have to say are no longer at the FIA, have been somewhat disappointed with Todt's behaviour this year, which many would say can only be a good thing.
I do think that Mr. Roebuck is at his most entertaining when he's being as careful as he can be. I do enjoy it. But I think the whole situation is extremely worrying. I take entirely the opposite view about Mr. Todt's virtual silence and low profile. I mean, I'd like to see his notebooks, and I'd like to hear the tapes of his dictaphone, because what worries me is, what has he been doing all year?
He's been doing a great deal, Rob. What he hasn't done is scream and shout about it every other day, which is what we've become used to.
Okay, fine. But when are the results of his research, and what are they going to be? When will we see them, and what are they going to be? I mean, I've heard that he wants to improve world rallying. I think that's fantastic news. I think his keeping out of politics this season is also great. But surely the man, you know, knowing the man as we do, this must be the lull before the storm, isn't it? No?
Well, I think, if I can take one little thing, something that had driven me nuts over the years was the behaviour of the stewards at the Grand Prix, because I thought they were inconsistent in their responses to things that happened on the track, and sometimes, often, just plain wrong. And in some circumstances, quite sort of disturbingly so. And, of course, you know, for the last few years, until the end of 09, the stewards were advised by an FIA man who was very much Max's right-hand man. He ain't there now.
No, okay.
Instead of which, we have a driver advising the stewards, which common sense would tell you should have happened years and years and years ago. So that might not seem a huge thing, but as far as I'm concerned, it's not insignificant.
It's very important. I mean, I'm not saying that I think he's going to be bad news. I'm not saying that at all. I'm just asking the question.
I think that the thing about Jean Todt, I never liked the way he ran Ferrari. I never approved of it because it was so single-minded and focused on what was best for Ferrari, and he didn't give a damn about the sport when he was at Ferrari. It was just about the results and basically helping Michael Schumacher to his next world title. But the thing about Jean Todt is whichever job he's doing, whether it's running Peugeot sports cars or rally cars or Ferrari, that focus is now purely on the FIA and making the sport better. And I think someone with his drive and motivation and, you know, his political cunning will be very useful if it's directed in the right way. And I think I'm optimistic, actually, that he's going to do the best job he can for the sport, because when he goes into a job, he always does the best he can.
Yes, he does. The other thing is he has a complete lack of public ego.
No, I'm not,
much, rather like Bernie, as a matter of fact, in that respect.
I'm not negative about it. I'm simply wondering when we will see the results of what has been a year's research.
I don't think you'll see some big sea change. I think it will be just whichever championship he's looking at, whether it be rallying, Formula One, whatever. You'll see evolution, and you'll see, you know, gradual changes, and there'll be things going on behind the scenes in terms of who's running this and running that, and regulatory bodies and what have you, and just the structure of how the sport is run will change.
Well, one thing we can say is that the atmosphere has improved enormously, has it not?
Yes. Without a doubt.
Well, that's it for 2010, everybody. I really do hope you've enjoyed these podcasts as much as we all have enjoyed making them. It's been fantastic this year, and we'll be back in 2011 with some great guests and some great chat. So thank you, everybody, for listening and for writing in with so many questions during the year. It's been a real positive experience for us here at Motorsport Headquarters, and we look forward to seeing you all in January. Bye-bye.
Motorsport Magazine, for the very best in motor racing.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.